Welcome back to our study of Exodus. Last time we got up through chapter 22, verse 19, where the Yahweh Elohim are blasting out supplementary commandments over a loudspeaker system down to the Israelites gathered below at the base of the mountain. And that's still what's going on as we pick it up in verse 20. He that sacrificeth unto any god save unto the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. Yeah, that's a pretty important one, just in case you didn't pick up on that from the very first commandment in the top 10. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Or, as I would prefer to say, before us. Thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Strangers in a strange land. And it was a strange land with all those pyramids and mummies and sphinxes and, other things that must have seemed pretty foreign to the Israelites. So they're telling them to have a little empathy for people that are in a similar situation and treat them the way that you would want to be treated or the way you'd wanted to be treated back then. And this kind of anticipates a couple of later moral commandments, the first being the golden rule, obviously, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And another one that I can think of is Kant's categorical imperative, act only according to that maxim, whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. Kind of the German way of stating the golden rule. Ye shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. Again, anticipating the golden rule and the categorical imperative. This points out what could happen if you afflict widows and orphans. Your wives and children could become widows and orphans and be afflicted by someone else. If thou lend money to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be to him as an usurer, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury. Now, today we think of usury as an excessive rate of interest, kind of like credit card interest. But back then, any rate of interest was considered usury. Well, then, how could you make any money? Well, by lending to non-Hebrews. Because this verse says, if thou lend money to any of my people, the chosen people, the commandment doesn't apply to non-Hebrews. If thou at all take thy neighbor's raiment to pledge, thou shalt deliver it unto him by that the sun goeth down. For that is his covering only. It is his raiment for his skin. Wherein shall he sleep? And it shall come to pass, when he crieth unto me, that I will hear, for I am gracious. So not only could you not charge your fellow Hebrews interest on a loan, you couldn't even hold items that they needed as security. Or accept them in pawn, I guess. Thou shalt not revile the gods, nor curse the ruler of thy people. In other words, don't be resentful of authority, whether that authority is being exercised directly by us, your gods, or indirectly by the puppet ruler that we set up over you. This may be where the idea of the divine right of kings originated. Thou shalt not delay to offer the first of thy ripe fruits and of thy liquors. The firstborn of thy sons shalt thou give unto me. Likewise shalt thou do with thine oxen and with thy sheep. 7 days it shall be with his dam. On the 8th day thou shalt give it me. Now let's think about this. What would be the point of these sacrifices if the gods were not actually going to consume them? What would be the point of asking people to promptly pay their taxes, so to speak, by giving up the best of their produce, their wines and liquors, and the meat of their livestock, if all that was going to happen was that the fruit would rot, the liquor would get poured out on the ground, and the meat would get burned up on the altar? There would be no point. The point was that the gods would eat the fruit, drink the wine and the spirits, and feast on the barbecued flesh of the livestock. I'm amazed that people today think that this was all just ceremonial. These Yahwehian gods had the same physical urges that humans did, and they weren't shy about giving in to those urges. Remember back in Genesis 6, some of them even had sex with earth women. So it's really not surprising that they also wanted to drink some earth whiskey and chow down on some earth barbecue. They were lustful, rowdy carnivores, just like most humans. And most humans are like that because our DNA made us that way. You know, alien DNA that was inserted into ours. They wanted us to be docile bovine creatures, according to the early part of Genesis, but that didn't work out. Because in order to make us intelligent enough to perform the tasks that they wanted us to do, they had to use their DNA, which carried the lustful, rowdy genes. And you shall be holy men unto me, neither shall ye eat any flesh that is torn of beasts in the field. Ye shall cast it to the dogs. Now, because that would be a good way to pick up some nasty disease or infection or something. This stuff all makes sense if you think about it. It's not just superstition. And now we're up to chapter 23. Thou shalt not raise a false report. Put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. This is kind of a supplement to the top 10 commandment about not bearing false witness. Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil, neither shalt thou speak in a cause to decline after many to wrest judgment. It's kind of muddy there, but I think specifically it's what it's warning against is not to engage in or encourage mob justice. And I guess more generally, don't just go along with the crowd. Do what you know is right, even if it's unpopular. Neither shalt thou countenance a poor man in his cause. Now that seems to mean, for one thing, don't award a poor man damages just because he's poor and the man he's suing can afford to pay the damages. That's not justice. It might be what some people today call social justice, but it's not real justice. If thou meet thine enemy's ox or his ass going astray, thou shalt surely bring it back to him again. If thou see the ass of him that hateth thee lying under his burden, and wouldest forbear to help him, thou shalt surely help with him. Again, do unto others. Act only on that maxim, etc. And this applies to your enemies as well as to friends and strangers. Thou shalt not wrest the judgment of thy poor in his cause. And again, don't favor the poor in legal matters just because they're poor. Support legal justice and moral justice, not social justice. Keep thee far from a false matter, and the innocent and righteous slay thou not, for I will not justify the wicked. Now, this seems like a good time to point out the difference between thou and thee. You might just think they're two different words for the same entity, you. And in a way, that's right. But there's more to it than that. Saying the innocent and righteous slay thou not doesn't mean the same thing as saying the innocent and righteous slay thee not. The innocent and righteous slay thou not means you're not to slay them. And the innocent and righteous slay thee not means they don't slay you. So what this commandment is saying is not to slay the innocent and the righteous. That's kind of obvious. I actually think it means not to slay the innocent or the righteous, because, you know, you could be innocent without being righteous, and you could be righteous without being innocent. And I don't think this commandment is saying if a person is both innocent and righteous, don't slay them. That would be getting just a little too specific. And thou shalt take no gift, for the gift blindeth the wise and perverteth the words of the righteous. Now, I think by gift here, what it's talking about is a bribe, because, you know, the verses leading up to this are all talking about courtroom stuff, legal proceedings. So read this as, thou shalt take no bribe, for a bribe blindeth the wise, and so on. Also, thou shalt not oppress a stranger, for ye know the heart of a stranger, seeing ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Again, do unto others. They considered this an important one, obviously, because, you know, they repeated it several times. And it is an important one for promoting a smoothly running, productive society, which is important to the Yahwehlians because a productive society is a profitable society for them. In 6 years thou shalt sow thy land and shalt gather in the fruits thereof. But the seventh year thou shalt let it rest and lie still, that the poor of thy people may eat. And what they leave the beasts of the field shall eat. In like manner thou shalt deal with thy vineyard and with thy olive yard. Yeah, I don't think this is mainly just so the poor people and the beasts of the field can eat. This is just basic agricultural land management. If you grow the same crop on a plot of land year after year, the nutrients necessary to grow that crop get depleted from the soil. You need to replenish those nutrients by letting the ground do what's called lying fallow every now and then, with nothing but grass growing on it, what's called a cover crop. That cover crop, along with the grazing animals it attracts, will fertilize the field without having to spread a load of artificial fertilizer on it, because the cover crop will die off and decay and leach nutrients into the soil, and the grazing animals that it attracts will not only graze, they'll be pooping at the same time, and that poop is a natural fertilizer. 6 days thou shalt do thy work, and on the seventh day thou shalt rest, that thine ox and thine ass may rest, and the son of thy handmaid and the stranger may be refreshed. Now, we've been through this a few times now. It's part of why we're supposed to remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. And in all things that I have said unto you, be circumspect, and make no mention of the name of other gods, neither let it be heard out of thy mouth. In other words, suppress the history that there were ever any other gods, other competing alien races here on earth along with the Yahwehlians. You know, the Yahweh Elohim has got to become the only game in town. 3 times thou shalt keep a feast unto me in the year. Thou shalt keep the feast of unleavened bread. Thou shalt eat unleavened bread 7 days as I commanded thee, in the time appointed of the month Abib. For in it thou camest out from Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty. And the feast of the harvest, the first fruits of thy labors, which thou hast sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering, which is in the end of the year, when thou hast gathered in thy labors out of the field. 3 times in the year all thy males shall appear before the Lord God. Now, I think by all thy males, it means all the able-bodied adult males. And it sounds like that during these 3 national holidays is when those men would have to go to the Yahwehlian base and present themselves for inspection or whatever. Well, why only the men, you might ask? Well, because the Yahweh Elohim were a patriarchal race dominated by males. We inherited the patriarchy from them. You know, we inherited it from their DNA and from their society. Remember, there weren't enough females to go around aboard the starship, so that means there weren't many females in the military. That's why some of the males resorted to sex with Earth women. There just, you know, weren't enough Yahwelian women. And I don't mean to beat this to death, but when it says that all thy males shall appear before the Lord God, that's a translation of all thy males shall appear before the Yahweh Elohim. So the Israelite men would have to go appear at court before the Yahwelian council three times a year, not just before the big judge. I wish it had told us, you know, where that court was held, but I guess it could have moved around some if they were using temporary bases instead of permanent ones. I guess that would have made those three holidays movable feasts. Not sure that's exactly what that means, but anyway. Thou shalt not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, neither shall the fat of my sacrifice remain until the morning. More health stuff. Except maybe for the leavened bread thing. Unleavened bread for Passover might actually be purely symbolic. One of the few restrictions that are purely symbolic. You know, it was there for a reminder of how quickly they had to bug out of Egypt. The first of the first fruits of thy land thou shalt bring into the house of the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not seethe a kid in his mother's milk. I don't know what that's about. And I'm not sure anybody else does either, but it doesn't seem very important. But now we get to something that is pretty important. Behold, I send an angel before thee to keep thee in the way and to bring thee into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice. Provoke him not, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. But if thou shalt indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy unto thine enemies and an adversary unto thine adversaries. For mine angel shall go before thee and bring thee in unto the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. Now, who are all these peoples? We've heard all about them before. They were the occupants of the promised land at that time. So this angel, whoever he is, will lead the Israelites into battle against all these little city-states and conquer them so that the Israelites alone can occupy the promised land. Thou shalt not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do after their works, but thou shalt utterly overthrow them and quite break down their images. Now again, this may be to destroy the historical evidence that there were ever competing alien races that you know, you might have as gods before the Yahweh Elohim. Remember, thou shalt have no other gods before me or before us. And ye shall serve the Lord your God, and he shall bless thy bread and thy water, and I will take sickness away from the midst of thee. So do what we tell you, and we'll purify your water, keep your food from spoiling, maybe even airdrop some more MREs to you. You know what MRE stands for, don't you? Manna ready to eat. There shall nothing cast their young nor be barren in thy land. The number of thy days I will fulfill. In other words, we'll provide the veterinary services for your livestock and make sure they're fertile and make sure they can deliver their young without any problems. You won't have to think about that. You just think about conquering the promised land. I will send my fear before thee, and will destroy all the people to whom thou shalt come, and I will make all thine enemies turn their backs unto thee. Turn their backs and run, in other words. And I will send hornets before thee, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before thee. I will not drive them out from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate, and the beast of the field multiply against thee. By little and little I will drive them out from before thee, until thou be increased and inherit the land. And I will set thy bounds from the Red Sea even unto the Sea of the Philistines, and from the desert unto the river, for I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and thou shalt drive them out before thee. Now here is even more proof, if you needed it, that the Red Sea, you know, the Red Sea that the Israelites crossed was the Gulf of Aqaba. You know, since that northernmost tip of the Gulf is the traditional southernmost border of Israel. The Sea of the Philistines is the Mediterranean, of course, and that's the natural northernmost border. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in thy land, lest they make thee sin against me. For if thou serve their gods, it will surely be a snare unto thee. And now we're up to chapter 24. And he said unto Moses, Come up unto the Lord, thou and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship ye afar off. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come nigh, neither shall the people go up with him. And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, All the words which the Lord hath said will we do. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and rose up early in the morning, and builded an altar under the hill, and 12 pillars, according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings, and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood, and put it in basins, and half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And he took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people. And they said, All that the Lord hath said we will do and be obedient. So what is this book of the covenant? Well, the consensus seems to be that it's the text of those supplementary commandments that we've been looking at for the last couple of episodes. You know, it says, few verses before this, Moses wrote all the words of the Lord. I'm assuming that those are the words that were broadcast from the Yahwehian loudspeaker down to the people at the base of the mountain below. So evidently, Moses, if he didn't write it down himself, which seems doubtful, he had a stenographer or court reporter, maybe a whole team of them, taking down those words, you know, as they were blasted forth. He pretty much had to have done that. Otherwise, how else could the last few chapters have been reconstructed? They couldn't have remembered all that. And Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, Behold the blood of the covenant, which the Lord hath made with you concerning all these words. Then went up Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel. And there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of a sapphire stone, and as it were the body of heaven in his clearness. Now no doubt this paved work of a sapphire stone is where the intense heat of the rocket blast had melted the rocks at the landing site. And upon the nobles of the children of Israel, he laid not his hand. Also they saw God and did eat and drink. And the Lord said unto Moses, Come up to me into the mount and be there, and I will give thee tables of stone and a law and commandments which I have written, that thou mayest teach them. And Moses rose up, and his minister Joshua, and Moses went up into the mount of God. And he said unto the elders, Tarry ye here for us, until we come again unto you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you, If any man have any matters to do, let him come unto them. So he left Aaron and Hur in charge, basically. And Moses went up into the mount, and a cloud covered the mount. And the glory of the Lord abode upon Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And the seventh day he called unto Moses out of the midst of the cloud. Now I wonder why they kept the rocket ship idling all that time. Didn't they know that was a waste of rocket fuel? Yeah. And the sight of the glory of the Lord was like devouring fire on the top of the mount in the eyes of the children of Israel. And Moses went into the midst of the cloud and got him up into the mount. And Moses was in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. Now, was it 40 days for Moses or 40 days for the waiting Israelites? We talked about this time dilation thing already, so you should understand the concept, even if you don't understand the reason it happens. You know, according to Einsteinian relativity, maybe the Yahwehians took Moses on a little jaunt over to a nearby star system and back, just to impress him and convince him he needed to do whatever they say whenever they said it. They might have been gone a lot less than 40 days in their experienced time and Moses' experienced time. So is there any textual evidence that the Yahwehian ship actually took off with Moses aboard? Or did he just go into the ship and stay there for 40 days? Well, as I just read, the King James Version says that Moses went up and that he went into the midst of the cloud, the cloud being the smoke from the rocket ship. But the Hebrew word that's translated as into the midst here is translated as in the midst in most other Bible passages. For instance, in Genesis 1:6, when God says, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters." And in Genesis 2:9, where it talks about the tree of life being in the midst of the garden. So, what's the difference between going up into the midst of the cloud and going up in the midst of the cloud? Well, if he just went up into the midst of the cloud that was hovering over the mountain, it sounds like he didn't go any further. But if he went up in the midst of that cloud, it sounds like the cloud went up with him in it. Once again, the preconceptions of the translators affected the sense of the translation. We've seen that kind of thing before, most notably where they translate the plural Elohim as the singular God because they have a preconception about monotheism. They're prejudiced. Well, that's the end of chapter 24, and we're out of time, so we'll pick it up next time at the beginning of chapter 25. Until then, keep the faith, but don't rely on prejudiced translations to tell you what that faith is.